Good afternoon. The House Committee on Transportation and Economic Development will come to order. We have three bills from the Department of Land Conservation and Development, and we're going to go slightly out of order based on interest of some people who I think want to be heard. And we'll start with a public hearing on House Bill 2132. Zach, you're going to give us a hearing, and we'll see who wants to be heard.
House Bill 2132 just modifies the pilot program for transferring of development rights.
Thank you. I'm guessing we want to hear from the department first. Please come forward. I'm not sure how we address you now.
I'll try to guide you.
Okay. Thank you.
It's complicated.
Yeah, it only took 10 minutes in our meeting to figure
really?
It out.
You already know. I should ask our co-chair how to, or our vice chair, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Co-Chair Reed, members of the committee. For the record, Richard Whitman, Director of the Department of Land Conservation and Development. My title will change, but not until Friday, and then it will be an interim title.
Thank you.
So I'm here today to talk to you about three bills. We're going to start first on 2132. This proposed legislation comes out of legislation that was approved by the legislature in the 2009 session authorizing up to three pilot projects for the transfer of development rights from forest lands to non-forest lands. So I'm going to start at a pretty high level here and just introduce the concept. The land use program in Oregon has a number of main objectives, one of which is to preserve working forest for timber production and the timber industry. The program does allow residential development on forest lands on quite large lots, up to as much as 320 acres in central and eastern Oregon. And that's a right that those landowners have. And in some parts of the state where the value of that land for residential development is beginning to exceed the value of that land for timber production, we are starting to see shifts in ownership and shifts in the management of land where the land is starting to be broken off and sold in large blocks to people for residential development. And that's fine. Legislation is not about trying to regulate that or impose new land use regulations. It is about trying to create a voluntary, market-based program to create some incentives for those large forest landowners to take those development rights they have under current law to build residences and move them to other areas where residential development can occur and makes more sense, leaving those large blocks of timberland in timber production to support the timber economy in those parts of the state. I want to emphasize this is not a requirement. This is something where the landowner, actually both landowners, the landowner where the development rights are coming from and the landowner where the development rights are going to have to participate in voluntarily. And it will not happen unless it is approved by the county government that has land use jurisdiction over the lands in question. So you have to have buy-in on all three points from the forest landowner, from the receiving landowner, and from local county government. That's the basic idea. And this is three pilots. There is an acreage limitation of 10,000 acres, which translates into roughly maximum size of one of these things of about 30 dwelling units for each of these projects. So they are, I don't know how what you want to characterize that as big or small, but they're not enormous, let's put it that way. This is a test to see how this idea works. If it does work and we can get it to work successfully, we may be back to you to ask for some additional authorization for this type of thing, continuing on a voluntary basis, but we need to see if it works first. Obviously, we're in a time now where real estate markets in our nation and in our state are in the dumps. Nobody is doing much of anything in terms of this sort of transaction. In part because of that, but also in part because this is a new concept for Oregon, we believe that the incentives that are needed for landowners to want to do this need to be strengthened somewhat. We have, over the course of the last 2 years, sat down with several of the major industrial forest landowners in the state, as well as several local governments, to explore some potential pilots. And I think the bottom line is that right now we do not quite have sufficient incentives for this program to work, primarily because of the fact that the place where the development can occur under the legislation that was authorized in 2009 is quite limited. It's either within an existing urban growth boundary where people already are encouraged to develop, right next to an urban growth boundary, but there are some conditions on that make it not that attractive to landowners. Or I believe in urban unincorporated areas. So it's quite limited under the current law, and the basic thrust of 2132 is to expand somewhat the areas where this additional development could occur to, again, areas adjacent to urban growth boundaries, but also our unincorporated communities. These are existing communities that are not cities but have some infrastructure to handle additional development within them. And then also the legislation would increase the, right now there's a ratio of sending units to receiving units. In other words, if you have a forest landowner who could develop up to 30 units on their property right now, this would allow them to actually build more than 30 units in the receiving area, thus increasing the incentive for the transaction to occur. So those are the changes that the bill makes to the legislation that was approved in 2009. We've worked on this with a work group with representatives of local government, land use advocates, forest landowners, Department of Forestry. So I think we have broad support for the concept, and we do not have any amendments to the bill at this time. I think with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions. We've got a number of resource people here. If you do have questions, including Catherine Daniels, our person who's the manager for this program in DLCD, as well as Gary Lettman, who is the person from the Department of Forestry.
Thank you, sir. Are there questions? I could maybe start with one since I don't see, Representative Smith. Well, okay, so mine might be general and might be of some use to others as well. Could you take us through, I had some exposure to this last session, but it's been some time, and I'm not sure if everyone had exposure to it. Could you take us through, in just general kind of terms, the scenario under which this might occur and point out where the problem is that this bill attempts to solve?
Sure. And I think the best way I can do that is by, I don't want to identify necessarily specific properties, but...
No. Hypothetical is fine.
So I will say that the most interest in this program so far has been on the Oregon coast. And I think that, if you think about that, that makes sense because it's on the coast where you're starting to see land values increase because of the interest in residential development. And so the forest landowners have some interest in exploring either breaking off parts of their holdings or exploring residential development on the fringe of their holdings. So we have talked with several large forest landowners and cities and counties on the coast about taking a, let's say, a 10,000-acre block of land that is currently planned and zoned for forest use. That 10,000-acre block of land could, under our current land use laws, support... Thank you.
Good. Amazing. That
was perfect. 60, as many as 63 homes on it if it was broken up into individual holdings. And then talking with typically a city about an area adjacent to a city that is planned and zoned as what's called an exception area, so typically for rural residential use. about increasing the density of development that would be allowed in that rural residential development, typically now a 2-acre or a 5-acre zoning, say down to maybe a 1-acre zone, and increasing the amount of development that could occur there. That would create the basic transaction. And in some cases, it has been the same landowner who owns both the block of forest land and the exception area adjacent to a city. In some cases, it might be two different landowners. But that's sort of a typical scenario of how this might unfold.
Thank you. And that and your description of what the bill does is essentially to deal with some of the specific restrictions in making that transaction. That's
right. So if this actually went through, that block of forest land would remain in forest use, and residential development would not occur there, but it would continue to be managed for timber production. So it would still have that value to the landowner. They would capture, in compensation for that, they would capture some of the value of the increased amount of development that could now occur next to the city.
You anticipated my next question beautifully.
Yep.
Thank you. Representative Smith?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is maybe off base and is almost certainly irrelevant, but I will ask it anyway. As I read page 1, line 15 and 16, a commission order under this section may be appealed to the Court of Appeals in a manner. And as I look at this bill and as I look at the ORS's, I'm not sure that this section refers to an order. And if it does, I don't know that it refers to it as an order. And it might be, I mean, it's just a drafting thing, but it might be helpful. I may be just misunderstanding entirely. It might be helpful, instead of just saying under this section, it might be helpful to have something like under ORS blank through place.
Can you point us to where you're looking again? Because I think I'm confused.
The header, a bill for an act, section 1, sub 2, lines 15, 16. A commission order under this section.
I think we're looking at different things, maybe.
You're on a wrong, different bill.
Am I on the wrong page?
2132?
2132. Co-chair Reed, Representative Smith. We went out
here all week.
We went out of order, and I think that threw things off. We
sorry, Representative.
No, it's not your fault, man. It's not your fault. I've been waiting my question.
2130 comes.
We'll postpone that question and come back to you.
Good. I'll have my moment of glory later.
No problem. Thank you. Representative Widener.
Let's see if I can maybe bring clarity, because I am on 2132. I'm just trying to – I'm scanning through this quickly. Is there any limit to the size of the property lot that they put this home on? Is it 2 acres? Is it an acre when they break these 63 homes out? So would it be a total of 100 acres for the 63 homes? How is the development going to work?
Co-chair Reed, Representative Widener.
Widener.
I'm sorry, Widener. Excuse me. There is a limitation in terms of the acreage of the sending area, and that effectively limits how many units we're talking about, to a maximum of about 60. I think 67 was the number that staff gave.
63.
So, but in terms of the area where the development would occur, under current law, there is a requirement that the development occur at a, and this has been part of the problem, frankly, that the development occur at a density of 10 units per acre. So a very urban level of development. And that, that's something that neither the cities nor the counties are really interested in seeing occur just adjacent to, outside of an urban growth boundary, let alone, in many of these cases, inside an urban growth boundary. So in direct answer to your question, in terms of the sending area, that's something that would be controlled by the county based on whatever plan and zone designation they want to apply to that area.
So follow-up, please. So according to septic, water, things like that, the county can make that decision?
Absolutely, correct, yep.
Representative Lindsay.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just picking up on something that you said there, I'm looking at the pilot programs that are described, particularly the second, third, and fourth. They all appear to, the intent is to promote density. But then when you look at section 2 of the bill, which amends Section 7 of Chapter 636. Sorry to get technical. It appears to lessen the density from 10 units per acre to 5. And so I'm just trying to understand the reasoning behind that difference there. And if you need time to answer and get back to me, that's fine. But that's what I'm picking up on, especially when you just mentioned the 10 acres.
Yeah.
Is it accurate? It sounds like that might be part of what we were talking about earlier, where the 10 was too restrictive to make the receiving area viable or useful.
That's right. And so we're reducing the density down in order to make this more attractive to both the property owners and to make sure that it's something that's workable from the local government perspective.
So in essence, is it also accurate then to say that we tried 10, it wasn't attractive enough to be used, and hence the interest in reducing that requirement?
Right.
Mr. Rindy?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lindsay.
Sure, so.
I'm Bob Rindy with the department. It's important to note that the way that requirement is worded, the city or county must allow at least, now it's 5 units per acre. In other words, they could allow a higher density, but they must allow, and that doesn't even go to what might actually develop, but their zoning applied would now have to allow at least 5 units per acre.
And I want to be clear that must allow does not mean that they require that density. It just means that that's the upper limit of the density that could be allowed. It's not the density that the development would occur at necessarily.
Must allow at least, so they could go above that too. Okay.
Right.
Representative Vince.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What's the way that you formalize the land that loses these development rights? There's some means you must have of showing that those rights are now gone. With a conservation easement, there'd be something recorded that would make it more or less permanent. I'm just curious about the permanency of what you're thinking this does.
So, Co-Chair Reed, Representative Bence, the way that would work is that there would be a deed restriction or an easement prohibiting residential development of the sending area that's part of this transaction.
Well, the concept then is that this, for all accounts and purposes, locks down anything into the future on that property because of that deed restriction. To whom does the deed restriction run, and for the benefit of whom?
And Co-Chair Reed, Representative Bence, I'm going to have to get back to you on that one. I can't remember specifically what it said, but I think the notion was that there would be a third-party holder of either the deed restriction or a conservation easement. You may be familiar with our conservation easement statutes that provide for a third-party holder, and I think that was the... I haven't looked at the detail of this for a little bit, but that's my memory of the concept.
Perhaps I should know this already, but can you give us an example of who the third party might be, or a description?
So where's that? So that's Co-Chair Reed, Representative Bence. That would be governed by the existing conservation easement statute that's in law that authorizes a number of different types of entities to hold conservation easements. We didn't try to get into...
I understand.
Bill, trying to direct that at all.
Okay. I'll ask someone else that. Representative Bence?
Thank you. The issue, of course, is combined here because the focus appears to be more on where we're going to go with these development rights than where we're coming from. But I'm just interested in looking back at this brand new device, how logical it is to believe that when these rights leave that property, indeed the property is locked down. To me, that's a hugely interesting part of what this device accomplishes.
Yes.
And I don't see in it that conservation easement reference. Is it in? I just may not have caught it, but if it's there, that's fine. It's not on before us today. Go ahead.
Co-Chair Reed, Representative Bence. So that's in Section 1. I'm sorry. Yeah, Section 1, which amends Section 6. So I'm looking on line 24 and 25 of page 1 of the bill as introduced. And that language is existing language in the existing law.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Please.
Thank you for calling it out. The concept then is that when a landowner decides to transfer these development rights, whatever the use of the land is, that's it. Is that the concept? The 10,000 acres we're talking about is locked down in this conservation easement to what? I just want to make sure I understand what is gone once these rights leave.
Right.
What is gone? What are we left with?
Co-Chair Reed, Representative Benz, this is a good question, and I think it's important for the committee to understand this. What we're moving are the rights to develop a home on this property. We're not moving any other rights that go along with the use of that land. So right now, under the existing forest zoning, it's going to depend a little bit from county to county, but generally the main rights that are allowed on forest land are timber management and a series of a variety of I'll call them recreational uses are also allowed. Those would not be prohibited by this. It's only that residential development of the property that's being that particular stick in the bundle that's being taken off the property.
Follow up. Let me shift now to the units that have moved away, or the development rights that have moved away. Is there any distance restriction on that? I noticed in the last part of the bill there's an opportunity for local governments to try to enter into some arrangements so that these rights that were in the 10,000 acres that are now in
right.
10 miles away from Portland will share the whatever the tax outcome is. It seems highly complex. It has, and among other things on this, do you think that with this fix we'll actually see something happen, or is this just another step toward? Is there more we should be doing? Is my question than just what we see here to make this actually work?
Co-Chair Reed, Representative Benz, the bill does not prohibit a pilot that moves rights between counties. But I think it is highly unlikely that that's going to occur, at least under what we have here. Again, both counties, if it's a move between counties, would have to agree to this. And because there could be some tax effects of that move, I think that's, frankly, fairly unlikely to occur. So what we have focused on in terms of talking with counties and talking with forest landowners is to talk about a transfer within a particular county, and I think that's by far the most likely thing to occur. I can't completely rule out that there might not be an opportunity there where you've got perhaps a particular landowner who has property in two counties who wants to move things from one county to another, and maybe they can work things out with the county, and if they can, that's great. But again, this is a small start. This is three pretty small projects to try this out, see what works, and if there are things that don't work. And then we're going to need to have a discussion about whether this becomes a larger part of how we're addressing the use of forest lands in the state or not. But if we're going to have an intelligent conversation about that, we need to have some experience.
I'm glad you point that out. It does not touch the limit of three, right? So this is
no, it does
it's
not.
Still only three of these that could occur before right. we had more discussion about it. Do you have a follow-up?
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The local land use planning folks, would they be? I'm envisioning this. The 27,000 square miles of my district has a lot of 10,000 acre parcels in it.
Sure does.
And maybe there's a bunch of folks that want to pick up the, I don't know if 63 goes with every 10,000 acre parcel, but let's assume it does. I mean, that's probably not a safe assumption, is it?
In central and eastern Oregon, it's going to be half that number. Yeah.
So the follow-up.
Please.
So the local land use planning authorities might be highly upset to see that whatever the future possibility of mini ranchettes scattered across eastern Oregon are going to move to the outskirts of Beaverton. So yes. Does a local land use planning group get to step up and say, I'm sorry, you can't leave us completely bereft of any possibility of future development?
Yes. Co-Chair Reed, Representative Bentz, this cannot happen unless the county government in the sending area also agrees to this.
Both counties, right?
Both counties.
Sending and receiving?
Yep.
Okay. Thank you.
Yep.
Other questions? That's anyone. We have a couple of other people who are signed up to testify, so please stick around, guys. I'm guessing that this next testimony could, there's a possibility we might have more questions. So, Steve McCoy, I think, and Sean Jones. Hope I got your name right.
Yeah, I was trying to, my handwriting's horrific.
Well, it wasn't clear if the second, if the third letter was a C or an L. So. Whoever goes first.
Okay. Co-Chair Vance, Co-Chair Reed, members of the committee. I am Steve McCoy. I'm representing 1,000 Friends of Oregon. We are a membership 501c3 nonprofit. We work to build vibrant urban or rural communities to protect natural areas and protect resource lands. This bill, we feel like, is about the protection of resource lands. It's about protecting the best forest lands that are left in the state. The sending area must be an area that has very few structures in it. So this is for specifically for wildland forests, to protect them from residential development and to keep them in forestry, to keep them in timber production. This is a pilot project, of course. However, we would be concerned about watering it down to the extent that we couldn't take the training wheels off at the end and push it off on its own. So that's kind of how why we are here today with this particular bill, is something that we feel like if the pilot project works, if we get some development under this that looks good to everyone, then we just at some point come back and say, hey, instead of making it a pilot project, let's make this continuing legislation. And I think with that, I will take any questions.
So maybe it's only me, but does that mean you're supportive of the bill?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, we're supporting this bill.
Thank you very much. Mr. Jillians?
This is not April Fool's, Mr. Chair. Co-chairs Sean Jillians, representing the Oregon Association of Realtors, in support of a bill that 1,000 Friends of Oregon is in support of. You know, I think we've had some good discussions so far about TDR programs. And last time around, I was probably one of the naysayers saying what was in there was not going to work. The primary reason being that there weren't enough incentives for landowners to actually enter into this program. And it gets a little bit to Co-Chair Benson. Points about the sending areas, and you have to remember that this is a voluntary decision by a landowner to give up a right on their property that they have. So there has to be some incentives for that. Typically in a TDR program, what would happen is that individual would actually sell those rights to a developer who wanted them, so they would receive some monetary compensation for it. Now there has to be the incentive for the developer to purchase those rights, and I think broadening the scope of the bill a little bit provides for that. I think the sideboards were a little too tight, and the department saw that. Representative Lindsay asked a question about trying to increase density, and I think the thing you need to remember is under the current land use system, you'd have one house per every 240 acres or 320 acres scattered throughout there. This allows for those to be brought into, at 5 acres a unit, a much smaller footprint, even though it's not the 10 that was originally envisioned from the bill. When you look at what's currently allowed, one every 240 to 320 acres, it is actually increasing the density when you provide these incentives to it. When the Bigelow Task Force was together, one of their primary drivers is they said we needed to find voluntary market-based solutions to our land use system. Our urban growth boundaries don't tend to be voluntary or market-driven, and so this is a situation where public interest groups find the reason that you could actually protect forest lands, and developers can find an incentive that they can actually develop more in more areas, and it's kind of a win-win situation. It is limited to three pilot projects. We're hopeful that something like this is successful, and then perhaps then we have the broader discussion of what exactly that should look like on a statewide basis. But for the time being, I would just encourage you all to give the department a little more leeway in seeing how these things work. And with that, co-chairs, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Other questions? Representative Vince.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess the question is, I'm going back to this conservation easement device. This package continues the lockdown of what we have in Oregon, just a more aggressive attempt to do it, because the conservation easement is, if you can't find out what the terms are and who owns it, how you can ever make a change to that which is happening on the land when it comes to whatever this restriction might be. And I guess my question is, are there folks out there that are, we as a legislature, are we convinced that we should continue to support this device if it's not working now, when the goal is to further lock down the future flexibility of our already challenged system? So I guess my question to you is the give worth the get? That's my question.
Co-chairs, I think that's kind of at the discretion of the landowner, whether or not they feel taking that right away from that property is worth it to them. I think in a lot of cases we're dealing with lands that probably weren't going to get anything more than a house for every 320 acres. And so it does end up kind of being a win-win because we can see some future development somewhere. It's important to note that conservation easements actually are used already in a variety of different capacities. I'm really hearkening back to law school when I actually took a course on them. But there are tax advantages, and some owners choose to do that voluntarily for the tax incentives for putting a conservation easement on their property. This is just trying to give those rural landowners perhaps some financial incentive to do what effectively our land use system is already doing, which is prohibiting development on it.
Just to follow up, Mr. Chair, and this is really a statement. The conservation easement is a device designed for perpetuity, which is a really long time. And most of the ones that I have been involved in, we've always tried to put a limit of at least 100 years or something, because it's likely that things will change. And so it is interesting to see it here in this device. It's just a comment, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? I don't see. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that represents the entire list of people who have signed up to testify on House Bill 2132. Is there anyone else who'd like to be heard on this bill? I don't see any. So we will close the public hearing on House Bill. Well, before I do that, I will mention for the committee, I guess we can make a decision here. The bill is, we have the fiscal and revenue impact statements. We've heard the department indicate that they're satisfied. There are no amendments pending or needed, so the bill is available to us if there's interest in sending it forward today. And as I said, open for discussion if people are comfortable with that.
I would like to wait a little bit because this is a very complex issue, and we might be locking ourselves into something that we may not want to. Okay. So I'd like to reach out to a few more people on this and make sure it is the right thing to do.
Okay.
I concur.
Okay.
I'd like to move 2130 for a vote.
We'll get there. All right. Well, with that, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2130. And I think we will carry it over to our next agenda in the hopes that we can answer those questions for the rest of the committee members and have the possibility of moving it forward at our next meeting. So have I given the proper notice for that purpose? Okay, so
2132.
That's what I meant to say. 2132. Thank you. You confused me, Representative Smith. So 2132 carried over to our next meeting, and with that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2132. And the show we've been waiting for will now get to a public hearing on House Bill 2130. Zach, please.
House Bill 2130 just clarifies statute relating to the Department of Land Conservation Development reviewing local decisions.
Gentlemen.
Good afternoon. Again, for the record, Richard Whitman, the director of the Department of Land Conservation and Development, here to testify concerning the second agency bill being heard by you this afternoon, House Bill 2130. This bill is not ready, in our view, to move today. So I just want to set the stage for that. We are continuing to work on this legislation with a variety of interest, and we've got, I think, a substantive agreement on amendments, but there's a little bit more work for legislative counsel to do, and then it's going to be some work on the fiscal impact statements for the bill. So having set that stage, let me talk again broadly about what the bill does, and then I'm happy to come back and talk about particular sections if there are questions.
Well, we know of at least one.
Yes, we do. I think it was line 15. Broadly speaking, this bill is an amendment of the statutes pertaining to how the Department of Land Conservation and Development and the policy board that oversees the statewide land use program, the Land Conservation and Development Commission, review urban growth boundary amendments and urban reserve decisions, as well as decisions that are known as periodic review. And it deals both with the agency's review of those local decisions and with judicial review by the court system of decisions that are made by LCDC. So in our land use system, I'm going to sort of focus in on the urban growth boundary piece of this, because I think that's probably of the most interest to members. Back in the 1990s, a decision was made to have the larger urban growth boundary amendments from our more populous cities be reviewed by the policymaking board, LCDC, rather than the sort of technical, legalistic review by the Land Use Board of Appeals. So the review was transferred from LUBA to LCDC. These are decisions by cities around the state about what lands are necessary for both housing and for employment opportunities over the next 20 years. By state law, our cities are required to maintain a 20-year supply of land for those purposes. So they, I won't say regularly, but cities are coming before LCDC fairly often with requests to amend urban growth boundaries. We project over the next two-year period, we're going to have somewhere between 15 and 25 local government decisions to make major amendments to urban growth boundaries that will be reviewed by LCDC. Each one of these reviews can be quite complicated. The planning that has to go into an urban growth boundary amendment is fairly extensive, and particularly when you're dealing with both employment land and residential land, there are many aspects to those decisions. So this bill is a streamlining bill. It streamlines how the agency reviews those local government decisions and clarifies what the standard of review is. It adds in a requirement that exists for elsewhere in the land use system that if somebody is going to raise an issue before LCDC complaining about the local decision, they need to have raised it at the local level first. That's the raise it or waive it rule, which doesn't currently exist. So it incorporates that. It also assures that the review by LCDC is more of a broad policy legislative review of the local government decision and whether that local decision in the whole complies with state land use requirements rather than did you dot every single I and cross every T. So it's clarifying that that's the intent of the legislature when LCDC does that type of review. That's the first big piece of the bill. The second big piece of the bill has to do with court review. If somebody appeals a decision of LCDC to our court system, that goes to the Oregon Court of Appeals. Again, when those reviews were moved from the Land Use Board of Appeals to LCDC back in the late 90s, right now for the LUBA review, we have an expedited judicial review process. They have a fairly short window of time to make a decision on an appeal. That was not transferred over at that time. I think probably should have been. So we now have our really some of the most important land use decisions in the state, Bend Urban Growth Boundary, Woodburn Urban Growth Boundary, Springfield Urban Growth Boundary, decisions can require, if they go on the civil docket in the Court of Appeals, a couple of years to get decided. So this bill would do the same thing for those decisions that you have done for decisions from the Land Use Board of Appeals, and have them be expedited in the Court of Appeals, and that's the second big part of the bill. We have, before I move off of that, we have been in discussions with the Judicial Department about this aspect of the bill. There will be a fiscal impact as a result of that proposal for expedited review. We were aware that that was going to be the case. I don't know exactly how much, but we are going to have a discussion with you, and then we're going to need to make a decision about, in the current fiscal climate, is this important enough to push forward with that part of the bill or not. We believe strongly that both parts of the bill are important, and that our, I think you'll hear from some people, maybe not today, but when we have the amendments all ready to go, that this is a high priority, not just for the agency, but also for the development community, because of the large number of decisions that we have coming. So we believe it's important, but we'll have to see what the number is from the Judicial Department. So that's a broad overview of the bill. I'd be happy to answer any questions there might be.
So, Representative Smith, I'll confess that when you were starting to ask your question, I was fumbling to try to figure out where, so I didn't understand your question entirely. Maybe you could ask it again.
It's a small question. I'm happy to, Mr. Chair, and thanks for the testimony. It's just a drafting question on attention to lines 15 and 16 in the header. Oh, good. Now I'm in the other one. No, there it is. No, I'm in the right one. I have them in order. Commission order under this section may be appealed. But then when I read the language of the previous subsection, and when I go back to the book on the section, it's not clear that the section calls for an order. And so it may be that that's just referring to an order under things that don't call an order under that, or it might be that in the language, instead of under the section, we might want to say under ORS blank through blank. It's a small drafting thing, but...
Yeah. Co-Chair Reed, Representative Smith, point well taken. We'll talk to Legislative Council about that.
Yeah.
Other questions? Representative Benz?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is it your thought that this will accelerate, and if so, how much the review process?
Co-Chair Reed, Representative Benz, the short answer is yes. We believe it will expedite both the agency review of these decisions, which is mandatory. That's not dependent on an appeal. When these decisions are made, they come to us whether there's an appeal or not for a review. And then also, if there is an appeal from LCDC to the court system, expedite that as well. I think the best way I can illustrate that in more detail is to give you some examples of what's gone on in the last couple of years in terms of our review of these decisions. So I'm going to pick today on the city of Woodburn a little bit. The city of Woodburn started on an urban growth boundary amendment back in about the year 2000 and spent about 5 years doing the planning work to put together an urban growth boundary amendment. They at that point, it had to be adopted by both the city and the county. That took another couple of years to go through that process. It got to DLCD in 2007, and the decision first time around was done, I believe, in about a 9-month period. It was then appealed to the Court of Appeals, and then it took over 2 years in the court system for a decision to come from the Court of Appeals. And the decision said, LCDC, you need to do a better job of explaining why you approved this. I'm paraphrasing. So The Court of Appeals made that decision in October of last year. The LCDC turned that around very quickly in a four-month period and again approved the city's urban growth boundary amendment, and the order is expected to go out in the next week. So I think under this new system, I would hope that we can turn these urban growth boundary amendment decisions around at the agency level within the 4 to 6 month period that is anticipated in the current statutes, and that we can get a decision from the Court of Appeals within a 6 month time frame, so that we're basically spending approximately a year, maybe a little bit more, but no more than that in the state system to get a final decision. And again, that is if there is an appeal to the court system. If there's no appeal, then we should be able to get these decisions done in a 3 or 4 month period and move on.
Well, thank you. And I think that's an excellent goal, and I'm happy you brought this to us for that purpose. I could share with you other stories of other cities encountering the same difficulty, so I think that's absolutely great. The part about the raise it or waive it is of great interest to me, but the issue is the point at which this requires the issue to be raised, the normal point that most folks would know they've got to be there and they've got to raise the issue.
Co-Chair Reed and Representative Bentz, yes, it mirrors the normal rule in the land use system for things that are going to LUBA, that you have to raise it in the local evidentiary. You have to raise the issue in the local evidentiary hearing if you are going to take that issue on up, in this case now, to LCDC and then the court system. And that's the same rule. The notice that will be required will put people on notice that that requirement exists.
And you must have encountered situations where new issues were raised as you made your way up through the process, further extending the time. And so I appreciate this, having seen it in other commission situations, and we did exactly the same thing, so I'm happy to see you bring that also.
Thank you.
Further questions? Representative Wyden?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to guess, would have this might have helped with the situation in Yamhill County?
Co-Chair Reed, Representative Widener. You were talking about the city of Newburgh in particular, or the city of McMinnville?
City of McMinnville.
Okay. Because we have two, so we have two situations actually in Yamhill County. City of McMinnville case, this certainly would have helped. And that's another one that has stretched out over a very long period of time. The city of Newburgh is also having problems in terms of getting through an urban growth boundary expansion. And I think this legislation would help both communities get through this much faster than they are right now.
Other questions? I don't see anyone. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We have John Chandler and Bruce Miller on our list, please. Sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Co-Chairman, Mr. Other Co-Chairman, members of the committee, John Chandler, Oregon Home Builder Association, here in support of 2130, or at least the direction it is heading on behalf of the development community. Pretty much anything that makes the urban growth boundary process go more smoothly and more fast would be good. I think this bill goes in that direction. Obviously, there's some things we'd like to talk to the department about during the interim. They've been pretty open to those discussions. As we all know, urban growth boundary amendments are always controversial. They're always difficult. They should have a lot of process. We may have gotten a little carried away on the process part, and this helps, I think, in that direction. We commend it to you. We look forward to the amendments and continued discussions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chandler. Mr. Miller?
Good afternoon, co-chairs and members of the committee. My name is Bruce Miller. I'm senior staff counsel in the Office of the State Court Administrator. We're studying the bill. We just wanted to alert you that our first impression is this will very well could have a very significant impact on the Court of Appeals. We'll get back to you with more information on that after we've completed our study. And, of course, we at the committee's pleasure would be more than happy to come and give you a fuller explanation at a future hearing. Thank you.
Questions? Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I met with the Chief Justice last week. I think it was last week. And he explained to me some of the steps he'd been taking to expedite and streamline our judicial processes in Oregon. This appears to me to be consistent with what he's about. And so I'm hopeful that we'll be able to make it work. And I realize the fiscal cost is going to be an issue. But if there's anything that we can do to try to help our economy move through this malaise we find ourselves in, this is one of those steps. And so I'm hopeful that we'll be able to help you find whatever the fiscal needs may be. And I'm sure this is consistent with what I heard from the Chief Justice. So I'm hopeful that I didn't hear wrong.
Yeah, co-chairs Representative Benson, that is consistent with what you've heard from the chief. The programs that he discussed with you are at the trial court level. The problem we face in the Court of Appeals is that the workload is overwhelming the Court of Appeals for the amount of resource they have. We actually have a policy option package to try to address that, and this would all flow into that conversation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just say that if there is ever an illustration of how important the Court of Appeals and that system is to what we're about in the state, this is it. And so sometimes I think the system is overlooked as a necessary part of what we need to get done. And so I'm hopeful that our Ways and Means folks will recognize the value of what you bring before them.
Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to hear a bit more about what the Court of Appeals has in mind. I'm trying to picture whether this is an issue of there's something is so different about the process that there will literally be more, either more actions or more appeals of actions, or it's just a case of appeals will happen at a different point in time. Are we suddenly going to have many more urban growth boundary decisions or actions so that there would be a net increase in things that might be appealed?
Is this also one of the times we might ask the director back up to if he wants to comment on that same question?
Sure.
They will have ideas as well, but that might be a question to ask all of them.
Co-chair, for the record, Richard Whitman, Director of Department of Land Conservation and Development. Co-chair Reed, Representative Nathanson. Question's a little complicated, so let me break it out into parts. In terms of the number of these things, we are seeing a significant increase in the number of these decisions to expand urban growth boundaries by a significant amount. And there's a reason for that. It's not just happening willy-nilly. The reason has to do with the history of the land use program and reflects that when urban growth boundaries were first established for cities in the state, they were established with a 20-year, we'll just say, plus land supply in many cases. And so historically, we are coming to a point in the program where many cities are starting to really run up against real limits in terms of land supply. And as a result, we are going through a phase where we're going to have a significant number of these, whether or not we have this legislation. In terms of the impact on the court system, we probably want to wait and hear the details from the Court of Appeals, but generally, these are complicated cases, and if they are expedited, I think it does increase the burden, if you will, on a judge to sit down and make the time to get an opinion out quickly. There's a little less time to rely on the parties to do a lot of the briefing and research in these cases, so I think there is some effect of that.
Please.
Thank you. My first reaction is I live in a neighborhood where all the houses were built at about the same time, and all of our 30-year roofs are going to need to be replaced at the same time. So in a way, that's what you're describing. We're hitting a bubble, if you will, in activity. I'm trying to figure out what difference this bill is going to make, though, in the workload for the Court of Appeals and how it might impact costs. Is there a net difference in the number, because of this bill, is there a net difference in the number of things that go to the Court of Appeals or in the time it takes to make a decision? Or are we talking about perhaps the other issue that we heard, how quickly an opinion has to be developed?
Representative Nathanson, I feel like you're giving us a preview of what happens in Ways and Means, and as someone who's not been on Ways and Means, that's helpful. Thank you.
Co-chairs, Representative Nathanson, I think without having completed our study on this, I think our concern is we're going to have a very large bubble of very complex cases coming in all at once, and it's going to be difficult to process those. And the court is already beyond capacity. We just had a National Center of State Court study completed that they mostly funded. I believe it's the first one in the nation. And they've recommended that for the Court of Appeals to be able to meet its own standards, they need 2 to 3 new panels. For them to maintain what they're doing right now, they need one new panel. And then if we add into that 25 very complex cases that might come in within a year or two, you can see the impact it would have on trying for the court to be able to process those cases as well as process all the other cases that come before it.
I'm guessing you have a follow-up.
I'm just going to leave it with that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I think I have a follow-up. What I heard or am still unclear on is it seems like part of what the bill is doing is merely concentrating the speed at which that work goes to the Court of Appeals as opposed to whether or not it goes to the Court of Appeals, unless I've missed something. So from that standpoint, is it simply a timing question about the additional work? Is that what accounts for the potential fiscal, realizing that we haven't quantified what that is?
Right. Co-Chair Reed, it's both. It's work. If you're at capacity now and you bring the cases in quicker, how do you do them? You need some resource to do them. But it also is bringing them in a much tighter time frame than they would come up in under the current system. So if you spread them out over 5 or 10 years, you're going to have a different impact on the court than if you bring them in quickly over a year or two.
I think I understand. Thank you. Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe you can help me on this a little bit, because when I read this and I see we're coming in earlier on these events, we're raising the issue with the local government early on. That gives the people that are doing this process more time to actually get their facts together and not get blindsided later on to where it would speed up the court's process. They would have all the facts and the evidence there because everybody's done their due diligence up front rather than later on in the process. So wouldn't it make the workload a little easier on the court? You might have a bunch right up front, but later on you would have a lot less.
Co-chairs, Representative Widener, the problem under the way these cases are going to come up is that they need to be to oral argument within 49 days of the time the record is transmitted to the court. That puts tremendous pressure on the attorneys who are bringing the appeal to brief the case. And that's where the court occasionally has problems. If the briefs are not thorough, it gives the court a lot more work to do, and it's tough to brief under that time frame sometimes, especially when you have complex issues like we'll have here.
Other questions? See, thank you very much. We'll
thank
await
you.
Your forthcoming amendments. There's no one else who has signed up to testify on House Bill 2130. Is there anyone else who would like to be heard on the bill? Don't see anyone. So close the hearing. Just looking for a sort of head nod here. Are we expecting the amendments to 2130 in the near future? Sorry, I should have asked that before you left. And I do understand we do have one, but there have been some subsequent needs identified.
There is a subsequent request, not from the department, but from a particular local government for an amendment that needs to get drafted still. So
you're in support of that new request?
We are.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And do we have an expectation when that might be available?
We need to get a note, but it'll be very easy to draft, and it should I'm not sure what the current status with legislative council is.
Okay. So we will carry over House Bill 2130 to our next agenda as well, in the hopes that we'll have that clarified and figured out by then. Thank you. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2130. Don't go too far, because we're back on House Bill 2131. Now open a public hearing, and Zach, can get started, please.
House Bill 2131 modifies criteria for reviewing needed housing within an urban growth boundary.
Thank you. Mr. Director.
Thank you, Co-Chair Reed, and members of the committee. For the record, Richard Whitman, Director of Department of Land Conservation and Development. I'm going to let the very able Mr. Windy take the lead on describing this particular bill. It has to do with needed housing, and again, it's a clarification of existing law that we have worked extensively with both local government and with land use advocates. But with that, I'll let Mr. Rindy talk about the substance.
Thank you. Mr. Rindy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, I'm Bob Rindy, policy analyst with the Department of Land Conservation and Development. House Bill 2131 has to do with a string of statutes that we call the needed housing statutes. And these date from 1981. In general, these provisions, again, apply to urban growth boundaries, which we just talked about quite a bit. Urban growth boundaries include a land supply, a 20-year land supply, and that land supply, of course, includes land intended for housing, planned and zoned for housing. And as local governments plan that land, they are required to provide for some needed housing types and to provide for enough of those housing types for their projected population in 20 years. These statutes have to do with the way that zoning is applied, and even more importantly, with the way that development permits for needed housing are approved by local governments over the 20-year planning period as developers come in to develop housing. 197.303 and 197.307 in general is intended to make sure that the conditions of approval and the procedures for approval of permits for development of needed housing are clear and objective and do not in and of themselves have the effect of precluding those housing types. And this statute, where I think it was very clear in its inception in 1981, these statutes have been amended frequently between now and going back to that time period. And I think many or all of the parties that we've worked with are in agreement that it's no longer a clear, consistent, understandable whole, and that if we could clean this up in a policy-neutral way, we actually help local governments and citizens understand it better, and most importantly, we can include a lot of case law interpreting these provisions. When that case law occurs, attorneys can research it and find it, but it's not clear in the statutes. So in summary, what we're proposing here is a policy-neutral house cleaning of these statutes to make the policies clear as they are currently interpreted by the courts, bring in wording that reflects that case law, and as a consequence, I think we will get much better ease for local governments to follow these provisions. There's been a group of folks in our work groups to develop this legislation, both developers, land use advocates, local governments, and all of those groups have worked on this. But I do think what you're going to hear today is that we're still working at some of the details here. We do have a set of amendments, -1 amendments, I think, that just came to us by email today. I just heard that you don't even have those yet. But they are not complete yet. They reflect some of the changes that have been raised to us in our meetings, but recently more of those have come. So we do anticipate another set of amendments. Quickly to what those amendments do, there's a related item to this, and that is that local governments have been required for about 10 years to report. What is the density they allow? What is, as various permits are approved for housing, what is the density that was approved? We have not been getting that reporting, and it's not clear that we have an authority to require it. It is required by statute. We proposed to tinker with that, at least especially to make sure that reporting could be done electronically. It only applies to the larger jurisdictions over 25,000. And I think we perhaps got a little too aggressive in that. We, in meeting with the group, we have agreed to pull back on those provisions, leave the core of that, but some of that will be eliminated, and you'll probably hear from others on that. And then finally, at the end of the bill, you'll see a requirement for LCDC to do further rulemaking on clear and objective standards. I think it's well understood that LCDC has an authority today to do that if it's necessary, and the work group, upon seeing the draft, concluded that it wouldn't be wise to simply mandate rulemaking where that may or may not be needed. So in a nutshell, that's the overview, but I'll be happy to answer questions. I know that some of these provisions are very technical, and I know there are folks here today who also want to testify on this who can fill you in.
Thank you. Did you mean to say 2,500 or 25,000? I just noticed that you said, I think you said 25,000, and I see early in the bill 2,500. I just want to make sure I understand.
That's Mr. Chair, thank you. That is one of the provisions that should have been drafted as 25,000. It is not in it, and so we're taking care of that in the amendments.
Got it. Okay. I imagine. Well, let me ask the committee. Would the committee rather ask questions now, or we have several people who have signed up to testify, and maybe at the risk of making a suggestion, we might hear from those groups first to identify other issues, and then ask the department back if we uncover issues they can respond to. Is that agreeable?
Okay, let's do that.
And sure. Co-Chair Reed, my apologies, but I have a 215 with the governor, so I'm going to leave you in the able hands of Jim Rue, my deputy director, and Bob Rindy.
Thank you. We appreciate you being here. Yeah. Okay, so we'll start on the list. John Chandler, Mary Kyle McCurdy, and Linda Ludwig, please. Linda doesn't look like she's here anymore, so Don Meyer, you're here.
That'd be fine, Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee. Again, John Chandler, Oregon Home Builder Association, here in support of House Bill 2131. I just sent Ms. Ludwig a text. She's down testifying in another committee hearing. Told her that she was be up next. I'm sure she'll be down here directly.
Thank you.
I just want to follow up on what Mr. Rindy described on this. This is one of the most critical sets of statutes as far as the home building industry is concerned, because it relates to needed housing, the approval of needed housing, and also is one of the areas where 1,000 Friends of Oregon and the home builders have historically worked together and are in agreement. That is the importance of these. I'll let Ms. McCurdy give her own testimony, obviously, but we reserve the right to yell at each other and argue about things on other issues. On this issue, over the years, 1,000 Friends and the HBA have worked together. We helped draft the initial statute back before either one of our time, obviously, because we're young. But we've worked on the amendments over the years, and we think it's very important to make the standards for approving housing inside of rural boundaries as clear and objective and as simple as possible. With regard to the tracking issue that Mr. Rindy mentioned as the first part of this bill, I do have to say that with regard to the city size to which this applies, I would need to chat with the department and with the cities a little bit about the number. I'm not sure that we are going to all that happy going to 25,000, but we do agree that making small cities go through it is probably a good point.
You like 25,000 better than 2,500?
I prefer 10,000, Mr. Co-Chair, just to pick a number out of the air. It's in between the two, but we haven't had that conversation yet. The point is, this is a bill that we worked on some years back that simply asked for data, and it's not intended to be burdensome. The amendment in front of you allows cities to submit it electronically, but the point is, when we plan our urban growth boundaries and look at land supply, we want to know what's actually being built, and the idea is if your zoning is 10 units to the acre and what is approved and built is 6 units, then the discussion ought to be recognizing that, in fact, 6 units are there, not 10. And it's simply a factual exercise. We hope to make it as easy on the cities as possible to do the reporting. As Mr. Rindy indicated, it's been honored in the breach for quite a while. We would like to, by putting this bill in, the language in, the changes to make it easier for cities to comply, and then we would hope to be able to come back to you in a future session and report that the compliance has, in fact, gone forward. And it relates to the bill you just heard, because it will make the urban growth boundary process and other land use processes go more smoothly if we have agreed-upon data that's been reported on a regular basis. And with regard to the rest of the bill, we think that the changes that have been made were good ones. We've worked with the department through the working group process. We appreciate them bringing the bill forward. We do believe that making the clarifications they did on clear and objective and when that applies and to what projects is very important. We commend it to you with the small quibble, perhaps, about the size of the cities.
And you've seen the discussion copy of the amendments that have been?
Mr. Co-Chair, that's an excellent question. I've seen something that was emailed to me, was hand engrossed by one of the other participants. I just glanced at the dash ones. And I don't know what else is happening with regard to the, I think these were from the League of Oregon Cities. What's happening beyond that, I do not know. So I'm working in some ways. I'll hopefully be invited back to testify when the bill comes back up once we've seen the amendments.
I think that's it. Certainly, if I have the gavel, you will, and I suspect that's true with my co-chair as well. Ms. McCurdy.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Reed and Co-Chair Benz. Mary Kyle McCurdy, staff attorney with 1,000 Friends of Oregon. We do support the bill. I have not seen the amendment, so I'll keep my comments to the bill. I support everything that Mr. Chandler has said, and I want to just elaborate a bit on this legislation, the statute, and Goal 10, the housing goal. This statute implements, in part, Goal 10, which requires every city in the state to provide land zone to meet the housing needs of all citizens, multifamily, single-family, apartment, large lot, small lot, et cetera. And we really do need this data. I'm going to talk particularly about this tracking issue because we need to know how well we're serving the residents of all of our cities in terms of the housing choice available to them. And neither Mr. Chandler nor I knows what this data may tell us in terms of urban growth boundaries or anything, but it will tell us more about how Goal 10 is operating on the ground. If cities are consistently approving residential developments that are vastly under the allowed zoning, that tells us maybe our zoning isn't right. But if the demand is for housing densities that are in excess of the zoned housing, that tells us something else, too. It tells us something about the locations. Do we have the single-family and the multifamily in the right locations in various communities? So it's information that I believe is really necessary to making sure we're developing to meet the needs of citizens in our cities. So we support the bill. We'll be reviewing the Dash 1 amendments, and if we have any other comments, we'll get back to you on those. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Meyer.
Thank you. Good afternoon, co-chairs, members of the committee. I'm Don Miner. I'm here on behalf of Oregon Manufactured Housing Association. We support the bill, but we have some technical concerns with Section 9. We've discussed those with Mr. Rindy, and we're confident those can be corrected through the amendment process. I'd agree with Mr. Chandler. Requirement for clear and objective standards is just fundamental to the system. If I could just a little walk down memory lane of what the ordinances used to look like before that requirement. If I could read one from a city, but it's a January 16th, 1980 ordinance, just a few sentences. And it's the standard that would be applied to a approval of a conditional use permit, which would probably be a mobile home park.
And what are you reading from?
City of Grants Pass 1980 ordinance.
Okay.
But it was typical. It was just one I grabbed. In order to grant any conditional use, the Planning Commission must find that the establishment, maintenance, or operation of the use applied for will not, under the circumstances of the particular case, be detrimental to the health, safety, or general welfare of persons residing or working in the neighborhood of such proposed use, or be detrimental or injurious to the property and improvements in the neighborhood or to the general welfare of the city. Lots of luck for a developer trying to meet that standard. Essentially, you would meet the standard if no one showed up in opposition. If the NIMBYs show up, you have something to appeal, although not much grounds for an appeal. With that, I'll conclude my remarks.
That was unexpected, very unlike the other testimony. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Are there questions for this panel? I don't see any. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We have one additional person on our list, given that Ms. Ludwig has not yet reappeared, and that's Mel Stewart.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mel Stewart. I'm representing only myself today. I'm in favor of the bill. I'd like to explain why and give you the horror story of, you know, of what's happened and why this bill is important. One thing we've been, when I retired from, I decided to build some rental houses. And to build a good rental house, what you need is low-cost land. And we identified some parcels that, you know, were in an ideal area, close to city center, had full municipal services, one-acre parcels that we could divide into three parcels. We first started by tying the parcel up on an earnest money agreement. We then drew up a full set of partitioning plans, went to the local planner, had him go over it with us, verify that indeed we met all the rules, that it was an outright permitted use. We then came back the next day and asked for a second planner to go over it again, just to make absolutely sure that we weren't buying something we couldn't use for our intended purpose. He went over it and said, yes, you comply with all of our rules. You shouldn't have any difficulty. We then purchased the parcel, submitted the application. We got an administrative approval from the planning director, very nice individual. We were unaware that there was a neighbor living across the street that was politically well-connected. And he objected and sent me a letter saying he objected to having any lots less than 1 acre in his neighborhood. We didn't take it too seriously at first until he went to his friend on the city council. The city council then appealed our approval, reversed it, made it a denial. We had to go to the Land Use Board of Appeals. During the public hearing, the city attorney was asked to explain clear and objective standards, and he got it wrong. He didn't read the statute accurately. He led the city council to believe that they had discretion and they were just making basically a policy choice, that they could basically ignore their land development code. Luba took offense to this, reversed the city's decision, ordered them to grant the approval, and ordered them to pay my attorney's fees. They've only made a decision three times in all history under ORS 197-835-10A. The city then appealed that to the Oregon Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals affirmed, but that cost me $25,000. And tied up the property for 2 years. Had the statute been more carefully worded, just more clearly worded, I think all of this could have been avoided. The court in Luba could have avoided being invoked. The Court of Appeals action could have been avoided. So anything you can do to not change the underlying policy, but just to clean up the wording so that people of common and average intelligence can read it without making a mistake would be muchly appreciated.
Thank you, Mr. Stewart. Is it reasonable to conclude that you think this the bill, there are amendments forthcoming, of course, but is headed that direction?
Anything that Mr. Rindy, I have great faith in Mr. Rindy, and I appreciate his efforts and that of John Van Lanter to clear up this problem. I gave them a copy of what the city attorney had said to the city council, and I think that I hope to indicate that they had a problem here that needed to be fixed. And I very much appreciate their time and attention that they put into this. But anything that they come up with would be fine. Thank you.
Thank you. We appreciate you coming. And let's ask if there are any questions for you before we depart. Looks like there aren't. We appreciate your testimony. Appreciate you coming. Given that Ms. Ludwig still isn't here, completes our list of people who have testified. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this may be to people in the room, or it may just be to the committee. One thing are we planning on? What's our plan and plan steps on this bill?
We are awaiting further amendments that the department is finalizing, and won't be taking any action until we receive those.
So in that consideration, I wonder if maybe somebody wants to respond, but I wonder if there's any value in considering amendments that would treat very large jurisdictions differently from smaller jurisdictions. And my understanding is that some of the tension is around single one-size-fits-all rules, and I don't know if there's any merit in considering anything like that.
Mr. Rindy, would you like to respond to that question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Smith. At this point, nobody has approached us this session to suggest this. But we have seen this issue being debated for a number of years now as to whether larger cities have more burden with this requirement than smaller cities. It's kind of counterintuitive, and I'm not the right person to carry those arguments. I'm just recounting to you that we have heard that from cities. We think that this requirement is at least as important in large cities as it is in small, and perhaps even more so because it is in the larger jurisdictions where we tend to see more of the higher density multifamily housing, the higher density single lot line housing, and the other kinds of housing types that where those cities are going to rely on that to achieve their densities. We, the department, as I say, we'll be glad to talk further with the parties on this, but nobody has approached us on this bill asking for that at this point.
So, Representative Smith, your question is another reason that I wish Ms. Ludwig had returned to speak to the city's question, but it's reasonable to say that the League of Cities has been and is likely to continue being an active participant in those conversations. The door is opening. She's here.
Ding, ding, ding.
How about that? We talk about her enough, and she returns. Ms. Ludwig, you're the last person on our list, and in fact, just before your appearance, there was a question asked that probably best directed to you, Representative Smith. I wouldn't want to try to summarize it. Do you want to ask it again?
Sure. Wondering if there is any value. Welcome. Wondering if there is any value in having modestly differentiated rules on very large jurisdictions versus smaller jurisdictions.
Linda Ludwig, League of Oregon Cities, for the record. Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Smith, in terms of this bill?
Yeah, and we're on 2131.
In 2131. Was there a section of the bill that you were referring to,
We can take the conversation offline. I would hesitate with you jumping into the pool and all of a sudden being asked to breaststroke, fly stroke, or some other kind of stroke. So I'm good. We can talk about it after.
Okay.
So given that you're here, is there anything else you'd like to say on House Bill 2131?
As I was walking down the hall, I got kind of informed about what the discussion had been up till now. And we are supportive of the -1 amendments. I believe that it's already been put into the record that we had a couple of small tweaks yet to go with those.
We hadn't figured out to whom we could attribute the additional tweaks, but now we know. Yes,
okay.
Thank you.
So, it was me. It is I. Thank you. So we will continue either to work with the department or get that language in amendment form for your further consideration.
Okay. Very good. Any other questions from the panel? Don't see any. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So we will await those amendments, and as with the others, I'll note that we will carry over House Bill 2131 in the hopes that the amendments will be forthcoming and ready for quick consideration. Is there anyone else who wants to be heard on House Bill 2131? Don't see any. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2131. Anything else to come before the committee today? Don't see any. Thank you. We're adjourned.